Succession number 20520, Reel 4.
Well, this priest, he came down the stairs and looked, spotted, and then he suddenly rushed at me, put his arms around me and hugged me, and he said to me, "You don't know who I am, but I know who you are." I said, "How come?" He said, "You were the young officer who rescued me from Mandalay Fort." I thought, well, I'm damned. It's a small, big world we live in. He then said, "It's very nice to see you, but we're going to celebrate." I said, "Well, I've got other calls." "No, no," he said, you come in, he said. And although it was 8 o'clock, he brought out bottles of brandy and made all the Catholic priests. And by that time, there was a bunch of other onlookers. And so I found myself drinking brandy with him at 8 o'clock in the morning, or thereabouts. I said, "Now, this is the end of it." But he said, "Oh, please do come again. I'm afraid I never, ever did." But those are the very small little things that happen. So Mandalay was over, and then we, as a division, were then heading off to Mactilla, where another Indian division was attacking Manila from coming across the Irrawaddy, but much further down the stream than we were. And we were doing what we call snipe shooting. We were cleaning up the Japanese. There were lots and lots of stragglers, lots and lots of poor, wretched chaps starving and things like that. But there were Japs around, still quite a lot. And unfortunately, I was leading a spread-out sort of shooting party. And I almost trod on a foxhole in the ground. A foxhole being a hole which had branches put over the top, which the Japanese were very, very keen on using. They used them a lot. And I, unfortunately, failed to spot this thing. And there was a Japanese in that hole, and he threw the thing up, and he came up with his gun and guts. I mean, unbelievable courage, these Japanese, really. I mean, sometimes one really had to admire them. He shot at me, and he was so low in the ground that instead of killing me, he shot me, and the bullet went just through my knee and through my femur and outside. And that was the end of my war.
That was your right leg.
That was where I was finished as a fighting soldier, and my right leg. But again, I mean, that was enough. I mean, he should have killed me, but he didn't. And I finished this story because the rest of it was really not really all that interesting, certainly not to do with my battalion. But my leg was in such a mess, I was eventually picked up and taken to a medical camp in Mactilla, and the surgeons looked at me, and they said quite plainly, they were talking to me, they said, "Well, this has got to go. He's got to lose his leg. I mean, but we can't do it." They were dealing with hundreds of casualties, so they strapped me up, filled me with morphine, put me in an aeroplane, took me back to behind the lines on the other side of the Chinwin in an aeroplane. I was landed, and there was a much bigger hospital there, a field hospital, and they again looked at me and they said, "Well, this is a job which we can't do. You know, it's too difficult. We'll send you back to a hospital in India." So I was eventually taken back to a hospital in India, and I was put into a tented ward, looked after, given food for the first time, decent food and all the rest of it. And I was beginning to think, "Well, you know, I'm lucky to be here, really," which I was. And I was visited by the commanding officer of the medical centre, and he said to me, Major, I'd like you to meet Lieutenant Colonel James Jeffries, who's just arrived from England with a team to teach our medical staff how to use... oh dear, I'm forgetting it now. What's the word? Professor Fleming did. Penicillin. To use penicillin in the treatment of battle wounds, gunshot wounds and things, he said, and he's looking for a bunch of guinea pigs. And he particularly wants to have a look at a femur. He said, and I've told him that you've got the best looking femur in the whole of the hospital. Are you prepared to let him use you as a guinea pig? Because you know the legs will come off anyway. But he's going to try and get it, save it, but use you to train other people. It's going to be, you know, so I said, help yourself. But he did help himself. And I've got it here to this day. He used penicillin of a sort which I suppose is out of date now. He had no proper equipment. He put steel things down my leg and my knee, put a nail through here, strapped it onto a sandbag at the bottom of the thing and filled it with sand to pull the wound apart. He took a lot of stuff out of my leg. But gradually, every day he used to come twice a day, see me, take a tablespoonful of salt sand out of the thing, chuck it on the floor, and it gradually let the thing form, and eventually I was mended, and 4 months later, although I was never fit to go back fighting, I was back on my feet, and thank God for him and for penicillin. If I had been not in that place at the right moment, I would have certainly now had one leg only. And that, I think, was my end of my war. I spent 4 months in hospital, and that was that.
Can I ask you one or two questions, please?
Yes.
What was the date when you were wounded?
23rd of April, 1945.
And... going back to Mandalay,
yes.
Do I understand that some Japanese actually surrendered to you at Mandalay?
No Japanese, no. People who had been locked up by the Japanese, no. The Japanese had scarpered. There wasn't a single one in the fort.
And when that Japanese officer attacked you on Pear Hill?
Yes.
With the sword?
Yes.
Was he running at you?
Well, he came, yeah, well, he wasn't actually running. He came out of the undergrowth and with his sword up, ready to chop my head off. I mean, he was 4 or 5 yards from me when he came out of the bush. The sword is now in the Worcestershire Regiment Museum because they gave me this as a war souvenir. And my Baluch regiment no longer existed. I was, at the end of the war, I was commissioned, a regular commission, and I was in the Worcesters, and it's hanging on the wall there now.
And the town clerk you were talking about, who
yeah,
helped you,
yes.
Remember his name?
Oh, yes, I remember it very clearly. It was Charles Harper Digby Seymour. Charles Harper Digby Seymour. And he was really marvellous to me. I'll never forget him.
Did you ever rejoin the Baluch Regiment after the war?
Well, no. Unfortunately, you see, India partition put the end to the Indian, Imperial Indian Army. And the Indian regiments, and there were many, more than 20, not to mention the cavalry and the gunners and the sappers and all that lot, were all mixed troops. My regiment, not just only my battalion, my regiment, as I said quite earlier on, were Pathans, Punjabi Muslims and Dogras. Now, at partition, the Mohammedans, the Muslims, Pathans and PMs, Punjabi Muslims, stayed in Pakistan, and they now are a part of the Pakistan Baluch Regiment. There is a Baluch Regiment. In fact, it's a very big one. But it's now called the Baluch Regiment. Baluch. They've changed the... Well, that's beside the point. But our Dogras, the Hindus, our marvellous Dogras, went to India, and they went into the Dogra Regiment. Now, the Dogra Regiment was... had three-quarters Hindus and one-quarter PM. So our company of Dogras went to the 17th Dogra Regiment, and their PM company came to the Baluch Regiment. The officers, almost all of them, were Indian. So they went to the Indian Army, but the PM Baluchis officers, or the Muslim officers of the Baluch Regiment, stayed with the Pakistan Army.
Were you in India at partition?
No. No, I am very, very thankful I was not. As a matter of fact, after I'd been in hospital for some long time, I won't say I deserted, but I did a naughty thing. I discharged myself from hospital because they kept me there another week and another week and another week, and the war was still on, and I got bored of them. So I was moved from hospital to hospital. I was eventually moved to a place called Secunderabad, where I was what was known as walking wounded. That meant to say I was up on crutches. I could go out walking, and that was it, but I had to come back and still be a patient. And I begged the commanding officer to let me go, and he said no. And so one day I packed my haversack, and I went out walking on my crutches, and I went to the Secunderabad railway station. And I was, of course, dressed in uniform. I was a major. I had got a medal. And I went to the RTO, railway transport officer in charge of Secunderabad, and I said to him, I have been instructed to go at once to ALFC headquarters in Ceylon. Oh, he said, sir, I haven't received any instructions. I said, well, that's not my fault. I've got to go. And he said, I said, no argument if you don't mind. I mean, I was throwing my rank, and that was very, very naughty of me. So he said, very good, sir, very good, sir. He said, there's a clapped out old chap, you know, of about 40 and all that sort of thing. He did exactly what I told him, and he booked me on the train. I went to Secunderabad station, I went over to Colombo, and then up to Kandy, where the Allied Land Forces headquarters were. And I was on crutches. I had my haversack, and I had a clean shirt, and I was reasonably clean, but that was about all. I was in my uniform. And I got out at Colombo, and there were army buses going up to Kandy. And I was dropped at the bottom of the hill of the Kandy, of the Allied Land Forces headquarters, which just had coincided within a few days before of Bill Slim, 14th Army commander, taking over the 11th Army East SEAC, Southeast Asia Command, the military command, Bill Slim, whom I happen to know quite well, as a matter of fact, but I won't bore about that. I thought to myself, oh my God, I had no reason to be there. I had nobody to go see. I had no papers to prove anything. And I thought, well, I have now done myself a bit of harm because I shouldn't have done what I've done. I was absent without leave from the hospital. God knows what they thought had happened to me. I don't know. Anyway, I walked up. I thought, well, I'll go straight to the military secretary and confess my sins. And I say, I'm terribly sorry. Do what you like with me. And as I walked up the hill on my crutches, down from some steps of a the big bungalow, at the centre of it, a figure came out with about six or seven other staff officers walking. I immediately recognised him as being Bill Slim. And he walked, and I was sort of, he came this, and he said, recognised me, and this is where people have to believe I'm telling the truth. He looked at me and he said, "What are you doing here?" So I said, "Well, sir, I'm afraid I've absconded from hospital, and I'm looking for a job." "Oh," he said, "you are you? I see." He said, "Rowley, how many Indian soldiers are in the 14th Army?" So I said, "Approximately 1 million, I should think, sir." "Yes," he said, "that's about right, just over maybe 1 million. He said, "Do you know how many Indian Army officers are in this headquarters?" "I have no clue, sir." He said, "It used to be 12, it's now 13, and you're one of them." He says, "You go down that hut down there, and you'll find a brigadier who's called Brigadier Training. You tell him that I've sent you to help him train the British Army how to deal with the Indian Army." I said, "Oh." He said, "Go on, off you go. Come back if you have any trouble," he said. So I said, "Very well." Out of my absconding from hospital without papers, I found myself back in business, albeit on crutches. And there was this British brigadier, British Army. I mean, no offence to the British. I mean, they were marvellous. But what they knew about the Indian Army was not very much. And I was sent to be his number two training officer, which was okay. I mean, that was marvellous. He didn't like it. He hated it. I said, "Well, you've got to put up with it. I'm sorry. But otherwise, you go tell Bill Slim and he'll tell you how, you know." So I was there for a very, very short space of time before Singapore fell. And I was put on the advance guard ship taking the advance guard of the army headquarters to Singapore, which I thought was rather nice. And I landed on the same day as the Japanese surrendered. And that was nice too. I thought that's rather interesting. We landed near Changi, where the prison was. We saw these guys coming out of the jail for poor devils. I was there for just a few weeks, and then I was summoned and I was told to fly back to England to deliver the Burma campaign dispatches, which had to be handled by a class two officer, no rank under the major was allowed to hold them. And so I was put on an airplane and flown back to England. And I hadn't been to England since January 1941. End of subject.
How had you come to know Bill Slim?
In my brigade, three battalions, 2nd Battalion of the Worcesters, I mentioned, the 1st 6th Gurkha Regiment, and the 5th 10th Baloch Regiment. Bill Slim, in his younger days, commanded the 1st 6th Gurkhas. And you will always be told by any professional soldiers that the best command in the whole of the army is to command your own battalion. Because once you cease being a battalion commander, you become staff officers and all that sort of thing. But your battalion is your family. Bill Slim was very proud to be CO of the 1st 6th. And even long before he became commander of the 14th Army, when he came back from the desert, he used to use every excuse he possibly could to visit the 1st 6th Gurkhas. Not only to see the officers, but mostly to see the chaps, the soldiers, the Gurkha soldiers, whom he knew very well. and he was a inbuilt natural soldier, and he never ever failed to come and visit the 5th 10th Wallachians. He didn't go to the Worcesters, that was a British thing, but he came to see us. He used to come to our mess, we used to talk about things, and we got to know him very, very well.
What kind of a chap was he?
He is without a doubt the most marvellous, most remarkable man I've ever, ever had the privilege of working for and with. He's a soldier from the bottom to the top. Gentle, strict, honest, clever, but a thorough gentleman in every way. And there's nobody that I can think of as not only loved him, but he was worth another division in the 14th Army all by himself. He turned up one day in Burma. He used to visit us regularly. Came just wherever we were fighting, and he'd come and see us, even if it was only for 5 minutes. He never, ever failed, because he used to see his first six, you see, was his pride and joy. But he never forgot us. So I did really know him quite well. I know it's sort of a pompous thing to say, but he was one of the great inspirations for us all. I mean, he and the general who commanded the 19th Indian Division, Pete Rees, were two outstanding Indian Army officers. And Bill Stedman was out of doubt. I mean, there were two others who I did not have the privilege of knowing, was General Wavell and Auchinleck. They were pretty big and important chaps, but they weren't soldiers like Bill Slim. Anyway, that was that.
For what were you awarded the NC?
I like to say it's not my MC. It's my chaps, MC chaps, my soldiers. But I was their commanding officer. I was with them for a very long time. I got to know them all, not only them, but the rest of the battalion. And Per Hild got a very great number of medals, and they were quite rightly for our viceroys, commissioned officers, and our men. But the three of us, the three, Paddy Massey, the C Company commander, who was a Pathan with a Dogra company, and myself, we got MCs. And really, we wouldn't have had MCs if our chaps had not done the job that they did. But they were. That's why I got it. I mean, sadly, I have never seen my soldiers ever again. You see, that was the end of it. That was my greatest sadness. After I was wounded, I was gone. I've never, ever seen my soldiers. I've been back to Pakistan a number of times, and I've twice been to the Baloch Regimental Centre in Abbottabad. I have once, by courtesy of them, and they took me, back to the Landed Kotal and the Khyber Pass, where I was as a boy soldier. So I've been back, but they weren't my own men.
How do you feel now about having served with the Baloch Regiment in the Second World War?
How would I like what?
How do you feel now about having served with the Baloch Regiment in the Second World War?
Oh, well, I mean, I am absolutely devoted to them. I mean, we do everything we can. I'm the chairman of our Baloch Regiment Association Club. We don't like the fact that they are Pakistanis because our regiment was mixed. But the Baloch Regiment has honoured and still keeps all our regimental customs. They wear the same uniforms. The only thing they've done is to slightly change the badge, cap badge, by putting, instead of the cross, which was 10 that we used to have on our hat, they've turned it into swords, like so, but it's still called the Baluch Regiment, not the 10th Baluch, which we were. And we, those of us who've had the chance of going back to the regimental centre have been treated like royalty. I mean, it's marvellous. But, as I said, I mean, that has not altered our fondness and great regard for our marvellous Dogras who are now in the Indian Army. They were really marvellous people. But, no, I'm sorry that Pakistan is in a mess. I think, if I dare say it, that the soldiers are about the only military only disciplined people in the whole of Pakistan. The crookedness, I think the Pakistan civil service is pretty good. The Pakistan police, I'm sure, is pretty good, but all of that is remnants of the training of the British. But they're all, you know, non-existent, really, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I'm just too old now. And nearly all these chaps have died or ancient, certainly not serving anymore.